Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from eastern Kentucky up against the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow window forecast about 28 degrees. Should be snowing tonight during the program, so if you're out and about, be careful. The solar wind is holding at 399.4 kilometers per second. Sunspots 1043, 1045, and monstrous 1046 are still there. This is the first sunspot we have seen in years that has the potential to ruin a digital day. We'll keep you posted, if we can. When the sun sets on Valentine's Day today, grab your binoculars and dash outside. Jupiter, Venus, and an unbelievably slender crescent moon are converging to form a triangle in the glow of sunset. You might want to run out there, if you haven't already, before we get started, and have a look. The arcs in sunspot 1045 are unstable, and they have already erupted at least six times this weekend, producing a series of C and M-class solar flares. These flares have caused brief ionization events in Earth's upper atmosphere, but little else so far. Behemoth sunspot 1045 is crackling with M-class solar flares, and that's not all. There have been many loud shortwave radio bursts over the past 2 days, reports amateur radio astronomer Thomas Ashcroft of New Mexico. Some of the bursts have completely saturated his receivers, and that's the kind of stuff that messes with the radios and satellites, cell phones. In fact, some of the high altitude aircraft are being rerouted over the poles so that people don't get too exposed to those energetic cosmic rays. NASA's Hubble Space Telescope has observed a mysterious X-shaped debris pattern and trailing streamers of dust that suggest a head-on collision between two asteroids. The most advanced solar observatory ever built is set to launch from Cape Canaveral. That was on February 9th. It has lifted off, and it is up there safely, assuming its geosynchronous orbit. There have been 21 earthquakes in the past 24 hours, only four greater than 5.0, nothing out of the ordinary. Terrestrial gamma ray flashes, also called TGFs, course through thunderstorms at about the same altitude where commercial airliners fly. Do these blasts of gamma radiation pose a hazard to air travelers? Sunspot 1046 continues to put on a good show. Yesterday, it unleashed the brightest solar flare in more than 2 years, an M8-class eruption, and today is seething with magnetic activity. It is starting, Earth Explorers. The next class of flare is X. And we estimate a 70% chance of another M-class flare from this region during the next 24 hours. The chief effect of impulsive M flares is to ionize the upper layers of Earth's atmosphere. Waves of ionization can affect the propagation of terrestrial radio signals, suppressing some frequencies while boosting others. Radio listeners should be alert for disturbances. Hopefully there aren't any here on internet radio. As I said, NASA has successfully launched a new satellite that promises to deliver data about the sun. It was launched from an Atlas V rocket last Thursday. It is called the Solar Dynamics Observatory, or SDO, and its mission will last 5 years. The satellite will circle the Earth in a geosynchronous orbit so that it can communicate directly with several radio dishes in New Mexico. The SDO can continually offload its data stream without having to store or heavily process information on board. It is the latest NASA research program that one day could predict long solar rays from the sun. As we gain more information about the sun, we're going to learn more about what its relationship is with global warming, what its relationship is with cosmic rays, with the Aurora Borealis and the other Borealis in the South Pole. And this could be very interesting and help us predict many things that are going to happen. If you want to call in tonight, the phone number is 415-762-1161. That's now tied to all of the phone lines, so it will roll over and find us. I want to let you know that those of you that have had doubts about time travel, doubts about teleportation, have no more doubts. I'm going to read you a short thing from the MIT Technology Review. And then I'm going to introduce tonight's guests. I promise it will blow you away. Not to detract from the work at all, and in fact the problem in defining teleportation relates to an underlying problem in defining uniqueness. Quantum physics doesn't have a mathematical notion of equals, but it would get deep and controversial. All electrons may turn out to be the same particle. Or, conversely, the instances of an electron that exist at different times along its 4D trajectory may... continuity in the usual mathematical sense, since particles are nothing more than probability distributions. So there is no problem in considering the idea that a particle need not traverse the space in between A and B to be at B, and quantum tunneling is nothing more than that. And of course, energy and mass are equivalent in different frames. So moving energy is no different than moving mass. Tonight's guest, Andy Basciago, is going to tell us about time travel and teleportation, and you are about to have your minds blown. We'll be back in 40 seconds with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Andy Basciago, member of the Pegasus Project. You're going to learn what it is, what it means. You may have heard it on other programs, but you're not going to hear it to the depth you're going to hear it tonight. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Brooks. Happy to be on with you again. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, this is one of the strangest, most out there ideas that we have considered. We've seen it in science fiction. We've actually even heard about it as we read earlier tonight, science journals. Colleges like MIT and others are discussing it as though it were reality, because it is. And so what I want you to do tonight is, I know you've agreed to come on for an hour, and we'll try to do this as best we can. Tell us what Project Pegasus was and what it had to do in relation to teleportation to Mars.
Project Pegasus was a classified research and development program that was undertaken initially in the late 1960s and was fully operational in the early 1970s. It was under DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which alternatively in different years was ARPA, simply the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And it was developing different forms of quantum access for the purpose of performing remote sensing in time. In other words, to give the executive branch of the U.S. government more reliable intelligence as a result of the gathering of intelligence from non-local events, namely from distant events in the, what we would call the past and the future. And for the past year or so, I've been leading a truth campaign as one of the child participants in that program to explain what Project Pegasus achieved in different areas of quantum access. The two principal areas that it was working in was in teleportation. They had developed an actual operating teleporter that was derived from the papers that Nikola Tesla left at his death in January of 1943 in New York City, which were seized by two agents for the War Department. And my research shows, and my experiences in Project Pegasus also verify, were then forwarded to the world's most brilliant physicists that were then gathering in Los Alamos to build the atomic bomb. And that's where Tesla's papers remain. His papers were never lost. By 1967-68, they had taken some of his schematics and prototyped the device and discovered, to their surprise, that it allowed for teleportation of human beings without injury in the quantum hologram, basically by opening up a vortal tunnel in the quantum hologram through which somebody can leap and pop out somewhere else in time-space. Initially, during the early years there, on the surface of our planet. When I was a child participant, by fall of 1970, they were adjusting the device to allow for an offset into the past or future. So during the 3 years I was actively involved in the program as a child, they were pushing the envelope of time travel within the context of the Tesla device. The other device they were working on was an electro-optical device called a chronovisor that propagates a hologram that is so dense that it has a lensing effect on events going on non-locally in the quantum hologram, and it brings those events in the laboratory so you can either look at the hologram and see what's going on somewhere in the past or future, or if you're standing on the stage of the device when the hologram is turned on and envelops you, you experience being in that past or future time and place. So that device, by the way, was the work of two Vatican musicologists named Ernetti and Gemelli, who partnered with Enrico Fermi in the 1940s, and by 1952 had a television screen-like device that was with which they were tuning in past events. So 20 years later, almost 20 years later, when I was brought into this enterprise, the U.S. government was already moving people around in time-space, and it was tuning in images of past and future events.
Well, if we're able to move not just matter, not just information, not just flashes of data, but we're actually able to move animate objects, people, humans, around in space, not just across the surface of our planet, like between two observatories in two different states, but two different planets, two different times. My question is, do you think that the government or those that are in charge of this project have been using this for strategic advantage for the last three decades?
Absolutely. In fact, while most of my experiences time traveling for the U.S. government were in childhood, I was narrating in radio interviews throughout last year the fact that in the summer of 1981, I was asked by a CIA agent that they had essentially put in my life as kind of an advisor. His name was Courtney M. Hunt. He was career CIA. Whether or not I wanted to go to Mars. And initially I thought he was basically kidding me. And I said, well, would that be via rocketry? And he said, no, you know how we can get people from point A to point B. And so he was essentially asking me whether I would volunteer or, you know, answer my nation's call to teleport to Mars. And I really did not want to go, primarily because I simply didn't want to leave planet Earth. I just didn't think that it was such a happy prospect to touch down on another planet, particularly one that I believed was as forbidding as Mars is, or as, at least as I had been educated that it was supposed to be. But when we had a number of discussions through the early summer of 1981. I was then 19 years old. I had this background as a child in Pegasus. I knew what teleportation was about. And while I had time traveled, all of the time travel that I had done in Pegasus was on the surface of planet Earth. I had not left the planet. And there was very little discussion, in fact, that teleportation would be used to leave the planet. But what Hunt was approaching me about was the prospect of teleporting to Mars. And I finally said to him in June of 81, you know, late June of 81, I said, well, really, Courtney, why do I have to go? And he said, because the survival of the human race depends on it. Now, he didn't say the survival of the human race on Earth. He said, because the survival of the human race depends on it. And I said, well, that's a pretty mighty order. I guess I'll go then, because obviously that cause is more important than me, you know, my own personal experiences or destiny. So
did you take that to mean that there were simultaneous populations of humans on Mars and Earth, or that maybe Earth life had originated in Mars, or that we had already expanded a colony to Mars?
Well, I've learned a lot more since, but initially he was simply asking me whether I would go up there. And these CI people operate holding back as much information as possible. In fact, he didn't even tell me the basis for the notion that I had to go up there, because somehow it was tied to a larger enterprise involving the survival of human life. He simply asked me whether I wanted to go.
Did they have to have like a sending and a receiving unit, or could they just sort of point it somewhere out there and send you?
Well, when I was teleporting in Pegasus as a child, we were jumping through devices and entering tunnels in the time-space continuum that would then close, and there was no object at the end of the trip. But in these two trips to Mars that I took, first by myself and then with Mr. Hunt, in July and August of 1981, he drove me down to a CIA facility. It was basically an office building in El Segundo, California. I was then living in Los Angeles. And I entered the elevator that we had used to get up to about the fifth floor of the building. He had me re-enter the elevator and then went up another eight or nine floors. I think it was about floor eight. And he was talking to me through the intercom, are you ready to go? And he was kind of delaying. I actually got impatient and I said, light this candle. You know, so after really only a couple hours of training, I reached Mars via a jump room. So I can definitely confirm the reports of David Wilcock and Arthur Neumann and others who have described these devices where, you know, you're in a freight elevator-like device that actually goes with you. It becomes cylindrical about halfway through the journey, so you find yourself kind of leaning inside the device as if you're walking down a pipe, but then it righted itself back into a rectilinear shape, and when the door opened up, I found myself in an underground location on Mars, a U.S. base on the surface of the red planet. And as instructed, I walked up a stairwell and through the eye sockets of a skull-like sculpture on the surface of Mars. Mars is dotted with skulls and other forms that intelligent humanoids would clearly be able to identify as structures, but perhaps less intelligent predators would not necessarily notice as anything artificial on the surface of the planet. So, as instructed by Mr. Hunt, I walked through the eye sockets of this skull-like thing on the surface, and stepped out on the surface of Mars, and I looked around, and quickly from behind me, a human being bounded up and greeted me. He was a human being from Earth, as Hunt had instructed. There would be people up there to greet me. And then after a minute or two more individuals, roughly my age, I think they were a few years older, came along and just stood around with me in front of this skull-like sculpture. I was up there during that first trip for about an hour. And then I asked, well, can I go back to Earth? And I walked down through the stairwell, and I sat in the elevator like device probably for about 45 minutes, and then finally the door closed, and I had a similar 20-minute trip back to El Segundo. And 10 minutes through the journey, the jump room sort of morphed into a cylinder again, and I had the same kind of pressure effect. It was about as much pressure that you encounter at about 60 feet underwater. I had sought my scuba diving certification at one point, and I would say that it was probably about as much pressure on your ears and the surface of your body that you get at about 60 feet under the surface of the ocean.
That's about two atmospheres.
Yeah, it was somewhat disconcerting how much pressure it was, but it certainly wasn't something that a human being couldn't cope with. But it was certainly more pressure than you experience on a commercial airplane taking off and that sort of thing. But as much, you know, inertial pull on your body. It was certainly noticeable, but it wasn't that difficult to deal with. And then the door opened, and I was back in the office building in El Segundo. So the second time I went up with Hunt, and we walked around for about 3 or 4 hours. We went over to a very rudimentary stone building where a Mars colonist from Earth was living, and he was almost in a state of mental collapse. He was very, very much in the throes of sort of an exposure crisis from having been up there for a long period of time. He initially thought we meant him some harm when we entered his dwelling. Was it isolation, or was it
exposure to the elements? I mean, what was the atmosphere like? Was it 1/100th of what we expect to experience here on Earth, like Mount Everest elements, or was it very cold, or different lighting conditions?
No, it was about 60 degrees. It was comfortable. The temperature was comfortable. I think that the analogy in terms of the oxygen supply would be perhaps what you get at the 5,000 to 10,000 foot range. I mean, Flagstaff, Arizona is at 7,200 feet. It was about that difficult, perhaps a little bit more difficult than that, to adjust to the oxygen supply in the atmosphere. But the atmosphere of Mars is breathable, and it is not desperately cold up there, at least the area of the planet that they sent me to. I don't know where on the planet that was, but clearly the data we've been provided about Mars being not inhabitable because of its basic atmospheric and meteorological conditions is false. And as we'll learn tonight, in fact, that's part of the Mars cover-up, is concealing the fact that Mars is not only habitable, but is in fact inhabited, and even more disturbingly, has been the focus of a secret colonization project to put a much larger human presence back on the surface of Mars.
Is there another presence on Mars besides the humans that have colonized it?
Well, I had an encounter with three of those Martian humanoids who are very much like us at the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company facility in 1970 as they were leaving following their liaison with several U.S. aerospace engineers that included my late father. So I had had an earthly encounter with Martians. And by the way, Brooks, let me actually announce this on your show. One of my law clients was a personal secretary to Howard Hughes, and I'm soon going to be publishing an interview with her about the fact that when she was working with Howard Hughes at Hughes Aircraft, Mr. Hughes gave her several parts and instructed her that several Martians would be appearing at her workstation sometime during the afternoon, and that she should personally give them the parts that he had provided her. So we have a second account now from inside the aerospace community going back many decades of Martian astronauts actually being in liaison with our leading aerospace companies on Earth. So I had encountered, like her, I'd encountered several Martian humanoids on this planet. When I went up in 1981, however, I encountered some of our personnel on Mars, and I didn't have any face-to-face interactions with either the Martian humanoids or several of the other humanoid typologies that exist in the primarily underground Martian civilization. I have derived images, however, of both the human-like humanoids and the more extraterrestrial-appearing humanoids that are on Mars that I found in NASA's photographs over the last 2 years. And that is one of the major findings that my organization, the Mars Anomaly Research Society, has also been revealing to the public, the fact that NASA's rover photographs from the surface of Mars now show some of both the more human-like and the more extraterrestrial-like humanoids that inhabit the red planet. But I didn't have any personal encounters with either of those two two typologies when I went to Mars in 1981. It was much more of a controlled, exposure to the reality of the fact that we were teleporting people to Mars, and we now know the reason for that.
Well, have you ever encountered Martian citizens or Martian residents here on Earth, or seen any of their craft or anything like that in your encounters?
Well, yeah. During the 1972 encounter, my dad drove us over to Curtis Wright, and three Martians in silver suits were leaving the facility and got into a small conventional craft that sort of puttered out of the hangar and then did a big loop on the tarmac and took off at a tremendous speed. I would say it going from 40 miles per hour to 4,000 to 12,000 miles per hour just in the blink of an eye. They just zoomed off the tarmac.
And when you say conventional craft, are you talking something that looks like a Toyota Camry or something that looks like a stealth fighter?
No, it actually looked like a silver teardrop-shaped spaceship, but certainly not like a flying saucer or something that could travel in time space. In other words, it didn't look like it had a superluminal or faster-than-light potential. It was a very fast, conventional silver teardrop-shaped transport that was clearly far more advanced than what the U.S. had by then achieved, but was clearly not an interstellar craft.
We were still flying the F-4, which is considered a flying cinder block by today's standards, but that was about the fastest thing out there.
Right, so it was far advanced, and it would seem that they were sharing their knowledge of aerospace with our personnel rather than the other way around. My father treated them with great respect, and there was actually a discussion before they left, and I think we narrated that on my first show with you. But what we've since learned is the reason why I was asked to go up there in 1981, because in fact, just several days ago, on February 10th of 2010, we had this remarkable disclosure event involving Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, the great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower. So I'm happy to announce on your show that my very controversial claim last year that we have been placing individuals on Mars, and now the reason for that has not only been disclosed by a second planetary whistleblower to come along, namely Laura Eisenhower, but in fact somebody who descends from one of the most distinguished presidents of the 20th century. Indeed, it was President Eisenhower who warned us about the abuses of the military-industrial complex in terms of their influence in the councils of government, as he put it. Laura very courageously stepped forward.
I was going to ask you if you think that their access to time, their access to specifically the future, or maybe even the truth of what happened in the past in certain areas or conditions that perhaps we don't really have mainstream knowledge of what happened in the past. Do you think this special knowledge has influenced policy or methods or procedures that we are now using internationally or globally on this planet now?
Well, I think so. I mean, definitely we know that there's been trillions of dollars of black budgeting through the Defense Department. And as Laura's account now demonstrates, a large portion of that undoubtedly has been directed toward a human survival colony that they're building on Mars. What she describes really in a landmark article written by our distinguished colleague Alfred Lambermont Weber, writing in the Denver Examiner, is that in 2006 she was in a relationship with a young man who she later learned had been placed in her life, essentially who infiltrated her life, for the purpose of recruiting her into a Martian survival colony that's been constructed on the red planet. So here we find that 25 years after I went up there at the behest of the CIA, essentially because I was asked to, just sort of on that acclimation trip that I had up there, we have the great-granddaughter of one of our great presidents being asked to go to Mars and actually join that survival colony there. So this is really a major disclosure event, and I think serves to corroborate the accounts that I've been providing and that individuals like Arthur Neumann and David Wilcock and others have been describing, that yes, esoteric technologies have not only been developed in the area of teleportation-based time travel, but there was a specific programmatic purpose behind them, and that was, in fact, to enable the permanent secret government, that is, the secret space program inside the U.S. government, to place people on the surface of Mars.
Do you think this is a designed colony? Do you think they have a specific genetic makeup or political makeup that they're trying to achieve? And if so, how large is the colony on Mars?
I think you point up one of the critical questions is whether they're selecting individuals based on an effort to reconstitute a unique Martian bloodline in the human genome, or whether they're selecting for genetic diversity in general. We know, based on the really breakthrough work that's now being done by Jay Widener, that the meta-conspiracy that underlies Western civilization is the creation of the United States in 1776 by the Bavarian Illuminati. Jay says, for really one overarching purpose, which is to establish a survival colony on Mars to protect the human race in the event that Earth is revisited by another coronal mass ejection that is so severe that there'll be a mass incineration event on the surface of the Earth, which is a cataclysm that we know was avoided by humans who relocated to Mars during the last civilization. Now, Jay claims that they returned to Earth and interbred with the humans living on the Eurasian landmass, and that the origin of the word Aryan, in other words, the Aryan bloodlines on Earth, is the word Aries, which in fact means Mars. And so if we use the system of ethnology that was developed by Ignatius Donnelly, the distinguished American legislator of the 1800s, who did so much fascinating writing about Atlantis, for example, Donnelly claimed that the Aryan races were not the blonde, blue-eyed Nordic peoples of Northern Europe, but encompassed seven root races, specifically the Celtic, the Germanic, the Slavic, the Italic, the Greek, the Persian, and those Indians who entered India through the Northwest, through the Punjab, and went on to establish essentially the skin color-based caste system that we find even today in India. So according to Jay Widener, those seven ethnic groups are the result of intermarriage between the returning Martians and the indigenous human beings who were occupying Eurasia when the Martians returned after this catastrophic event that had caused them to evacuate Earth and preserve their civilization on Mars. So to the extent that there's been a selection of specific individuals for this Mars colony, actually, one of the coincidences we found is that Laura Eisenhower's Germanic ancestry is very close, ethnically speaking, to my Germanic ancestry on my mother's side. I've done some family heritage research and found a number of families from the German nobility that dates from 1648, which was the creation of the Prussian nation state under the Treaty of Westphalia. Her ancestry on her father's side is very close. And so it's curious that we have this secret faction within the U.S. government approaching young Americans who descend from specific Germanic bloodlines. Another esoteric or occult linkage here, according to Jay, is that one of the enterprises that was founded to sustain this covert Mars colony project was, in fact, the Yale-based secret society Skull and Bones. You know, it's always been a mystery what the numerals 322 on the Skull and Bones insignia mean. And Jay asserts, and I think that it's a brilliant premise, that 322 is simply March 22nd, which is the day that the zodiac makes its transition into Aries, which is Mars, and that this oath that the members of Skull and Bones that have included presidents like William Howard Taft and George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, current politicians like Senator John Kerry, that the oath that the members of Skull and Bones take is essentially to do anything that they're asked, including sponsor assassinations, to preserve, protect, and defend this covert Mars colonization project that dates literally from the founding of the United States. So we don't know what notions of genetics they're using to consolidate this colony, but if in fact this colony may be the only surviving remnant of human life on Earth following another periodic catastrophe on Earth, it really is an issue of planetary consequence whether a more eugenicist view of human genetics is being pursued in furtherance of the survival of specific bloodlines, or whether a more resilient and intelligent form of genetic engineering has been employed in which they want to create essentially an archive or an arc of the entire human genome on Mars. I would favor the latter because we know from the history of eugenics in the United States that the more you begin trying to eliminate bloodlines, the genetic diversity promotes disease and makes a species more vulnerable to basically debility and ultimate destruction. And so this really is a critical issue now. If, in fact, there's been a multi-generational conspiracy to create the sustainable colony on Mars that a confluence of sources now indicate has been occurring, we really have to ask how that colony is being constituted, and does it, in fact, reflect the great and wonderful genetic diversity of the human race on Earth?
Well, one of the things that we notice in large animal populations, whether they're bacteria or mice or rabbits, is that given enough time, especially with humans, what we find is a natural stratification of what would normally be a rich and robust and resilient genetic code. And as that stratification occurs, the various idiosyncrasies of each of those genetic propensities becomes apparent. You're saying something that I've casually observed, at least throughout my lifetime, is a reblending of the races. And you see this more in the international areas, planet like, oh, California, or you see this a lot in Europe, where you will have Asian and African and Western European and Nordic races all blending together. And you see the most beautiful, Amazonish kind of people. They're dark and they're tall and they're lean and they're healthy and their teeth are great and their eyes are great. And you're going, wow, what's going on with the human genome just naturally as these races are coming back together and not stratifying, but reblending. I know when we see this in animal populations, when new genetics or varied genetics, or at least many, many generations away of genetics, are reintroduced into a herd or a flock, you see the entire flock improve in resistance to disease and lifespan and in capabilities, both mental and emotional. Is that what is going on Mars, or is this eugenics more engineered from a political standpoint?
We don't know. Certainly what you were charting was sort of the immediate evidence that we can see with our eyes that genetic diversity is adaptive. I mean, you definitely want to widen the ambit of the human genome through interbreeding, through exogenous and endogamous procreation, because ultimately you want a current population that encompasses the broadest possible array of genes in the entire species. You don't want to go about the business of beginning to eliminate specific bloodlines or genetic patterns in the human genome. That could be perilous. That could cause, for example, a lack of resistance to a certain virus that could endanger the whole population. Okay,
that raises a really interesting question. My brother was chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins for many, many years, and before that was dean of physiology at Yale. And he was one of the launch engineers, although he was a doctor, of the Human Genome Project. And this was done ostensibly after many, many years of trying to classify animal DNA so that at least we could come up with a way of cataloging it, realizing, or should I say predicting, that the human genome would be the most complex of all, and finding much the opposite, that the human genome was not only shorter, but much simpler than most of the, even the ape-like or primate life that we find on Earth. Why do you think the Human Genome Project was begun in the first place?
Well, I think we have to explore whether, in fact, they were mapping the entire human genome so that they could sort of parse this distinction between individuals who have Martian ancestry in addition to Earthian ancestry, as it were, and those who simply have a genetic heritage that that derives from Earth. Because it's clear that here we have a situation in which Laura was being induced to become a member of the Mars colony. Clearly, the implication here is that when I was asked to go up there in 1981, I had been selected to acclimated to going up there. Now, to the extent that we have this small sample of two individuals who descend from specific Germanic bloodlines, my suspicion, and again, this is inference, it's not evidence that we have yet, but we had the mapping of the human genome at Cambridge University in England, and I believe it may have been carried out to kind of parse this distinction and identify specific bloodlines that link to the heritage that's off-planet, namely from Mars, and that there may have been a decision to try to reconstitute the Martian colony with individuals who descend just from those discrete bloodlines within the entire human genome. And I don't know whether that would be advisable. I mean, probably the positive reason for doing that would be that those individuals would possess recessive genes that might begin to accumulate and adapt to the uniquely Martian conditions. Another possibility is that by engaging in the creation of a Mars colony with kind of a eugenicist thrust, they may in fact be jeopardizing the long-term survival of the human genome in space if in fact there's a successful Mars colony created, or, you know, it's now obviously being created, and there is a catastrophic event that greatly attrits the population on Earth. Again, the issue is, since we know that a Mars colony is being built, this is an issue of overarching importance to what the human race becomes in the future and what its fate will be. Because if we select too narrow of a set of genetic bloodlines, that population may not be robust enough to survive on Mars. And so we really have to have a disclosure of what this secret Mars colony project has been up to and what are the decisions that have been made regarding how it should be constituted.
See, now I think that's profoundly important, this disclosure, because if it goes along with the historical dabbling of governments into the thinkings and doings of mankind, it's typically not a very intelligent intervention. It seems to be more social engineering. And it would seem to me that the temptation to eliminate certain undesirable traits of human beings would be too great for them not to segregate out certain racial propensities as they're trying to engineer this Mars colony. And I think I asked this question before, but I can't remember if you answered it. How big do you think the Martian colony is right now? And if you know that or suspect that, where are they living? Are they living inside the planet, or is there some kind of surface dwelling that they may occupy?
Yeah, my knowledge is limited to my trip up there and then what others have said in the intervening 25 years or more now. My God, it's been almost 30 years. When I went up there, there was clearly a substantial infrastructure of deep underground military bases. So, for example, when I went up there by jump room, there were bases that he'd either been built by the Martians or by our personnel or by the two groups working in cooperation. Excuse me. And after I published my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, in 2008, there was a disclosure from the CIA. Somebody from CIA called me and said that that population numbers about a million. Now, other whistleblowers like Arthur Neumann, like David Wilcock, have stated that there are now 500,000 to 600,000 human beings from Earth on Mars. Laura, I don't believe, nor, by the way, I should mention her friend Kylea Light corroborates her account, and they were actually both approached to go up to Mars and stay there. I don't believe they were told specifically how many people already make up that colony, but, I mean, when I was up there in 1981, there was already sort of a skeletal crew up there on the surface. For example, I mentioned the anecdote where Hunt and I went over and interacted with this individual in sort of this rudimentary stone house on the surface. The infrastructure below ground was much larger and much, much more extensive, but I was never told back in the early 80s how many human beings from Earth were already up there, and I don't believe Laura and Kylea were told when they were subjected to this recruitment campaign to go up there and join the Mars colony back in 2006. But certainly since 25 years have passed, since or 30 years almost now, since we were teleporting individuals up there apparently to acclimate them to staying there and becoming part of that colony, we can certainly extrapolate that it must be in the hundreds of thousands.
Well, now that you mentioned that these are Earth humans that are colonizing up there, I assume that there are some indigenous Martians, or at least leftovers from the last Mars to Earth remigration after the cataclysm settled down and Earth became habitable again on the surface. What do you think is the Martian population?
Well, I was informed by CIA that indigenous Martian population that has several different humanoid typologies in it and that make up the Martian remnant, excuse me, in the same way that, let's say, many of our ancestors remained in, or relatives of our ancestors remained in Europe or Africa or Latin America or Asia when people came here to the United States. So in a similar way, there was a remnant of Martian humanoids who are very genetically close to the humanoids on Earth who stayed there, and according to this source within CIA, that population numbers about a million and is made up of several different types of humanoids. And I believe those are the humanoids that we're seeing in the pictures from the NASA rover Spirit and Opportunity that occasionally show up in one of the photographs taken by the rovers.
Is there an opportunity made for these indigenous Martians, since there is this ability to jump between planets, for them to come and do a short tour, as it were, on Earth?
Well, I think that was what was going on, and we saw evidence of that in 1970 when three of their astronauts were interacting with our aerospace personnel. I remember that my dad described taking them out into the woods and going on different field trips on Earth. So those two human civilizations have been in collaboration since at least 1970, which now is, what, is 2010? That's 40 years. But what I'm saying is I don't know the specific number of the people who were born on Earth and are Homo sapiens sapiens, who have already been placed in situ on the surface of Mars. But if we're to believe the accounts of some whistleblowers like Arthur Neumann, it's in about the range of now about a half million. So this may explain some of the missing person cases. It may explain some of the situations where somebody, let's say, knows a gifted scientist or technologist of some kind who suddenly just disappears. And it looks like they've been at this now for a number of decades, and it must be a fairly large colony at this point.
Well, it would seem to me that if you're going to go through the energy and expense and utter design of creating a human population, a human colony, that this colony would be engineered and put together of people of the highest accomplishment and possibly even the greatest patriotism to whatever leadership is putting that together. By the way, I forgot to ask you, you mentioned the CIA, but what nationality is it that's controlling this colonization of Mars? It must be pretty narrow, because this is not mainstream stuff. We're still loading people into tin cans and putting them on board of large rockets and launching them into space as though this is our semblance of high-tech space travel. So what nation is in charge of this effort?
I don't think it's a nation. I think it's a secret intelligence faction within the United States permanent secret government. And I think this issue of secrecy that you raise is a vital one, because here we have a situation in which the human genome is essentially being ultimately protected from destruction by a strategic relocation on another planet. That is not necessarily a bad idea, in the same way that we tend to distribute our resources so that if they're destroyed in one place, they might survive in another. It's certainly a very intelligent plan, ultimately, in overarching terms, to provide for contingency planning fashioned around placing harbingers of human life on another celestial body. That makes a lot of sense. Regardless of threats to Earth, we know from the history of Earth that there have been several major cataclysms that have led to mass die-offs. And so,
well, harbinger is a good term, because, you know, we live in a very rich and lush, you know, resource full planet where we have the fortunate privilege of living on the surface of a world, which I can tell you, 20,000 light years in every direction. This is a very rare condition to have a planet with liquid water on the surface where you can walk freely under the sun without a body covered with hair or special clothing to protect yourself from ultraviolet radiation. But the Mars environment affords no such luxury. There's no ionosphere to Mars. There's no magnetosphere to Mars. The only place that you can live is underground. And harbinger is certainly a good term, because 1 million is barely an eyedropper compared to the 7 billion that live on this planet.
Right. So presumably that surviving population of Martians has been, to some extent, genetically corrupted, which would explain some of the crude physiognomy that we've seen in accounts of Martians on Earth and on Mars. For example, I kind of addressed it in a comedic way, but when somebody asked me, what did the Martians look like that you encountered at Curtis Wright in 1970, I said, well, the three of them looked like any combination of three of the four Three Stooges. I mean, they were pretty homely guys. They had very crude faces. So that may be attributable to the narrow genetic pool of Martians that survived on Mars. Now, you asked, what are we doing? You know, who's governing this? We know that a contingent of Nazis was brought into the CIA under Operation Paperclip. And we know that two polymaths, namely Laura and I, and individuals with different talents, not really specialists, but sort of intelligent generalists from specific noble German ancestry, were invited to go up there. Now, Kailia is a Chinese-American woman, also a brilliant graduate of Stanford University like Laura is. So it looks like they were looking for intelligent, well-educated, pragmatic generalists from specific bloodlines. Now, I'm superimposing that last element because I'm really trying to distinguish the fact, or just bring attention to the fact, that as long as this project goes on in secret, within the cult of intelligence, we're not going to have a guarantee that that survival population on Earth, whenever it might become necessary to actually save the human species and the universe, is constituted of the rich treasure of genetic heritage in the human race on Earth. And that's one of the dangers of secrecy, is that specific bloodlines employing some eugenicist standard of selection would narrow the human genome as it would exist on Mars, because, believe me, the Martians that I met at Curtis Wright and those that we're finding in the photographs from Mars do not possess the apparent beauty and strength and resilience of individuals you find it on Earth,
it doesn't sound like they're the best specimen of humanity.
No, they look like they're genetically compromised, and we certainly wouldn't want that to happen now that their evidence is surfacing from many different sources that there is this project to protect the human genome from Earth on Mars in the event of a catastrophe, either an artificial one or a natural cataclysm of some kind.
Unless you want to stay around for the next hour, I want to cover a little bit about the catastrophe or the cataclysm that may be coming or that is coming.
I'd enjoy that, Brooke, so let's go for another hour if you'd like.
Yeah, okay, that's great. Well, let's go ahead and take a break then. 6 minutes, We'll be back with more Andy Basciago after this. Just relax for about 6 minutes, no commercials. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio right after this. Remember, Earth Explorers, your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. Welcome back. Second hour of X Squared Radio. Lisa Gerard, Dead Can Dance album. Hope you enjoyed the nice relaxation. I also want to let you know, if you are interested in The Ark of Millions of Years, Volumes 1, 2, and 3 are available as a trilogy. You can order them all at once. We'll autograph them, send them out, and we give you a deal on the shipping, and we'll send you the first two books, Volumes 1 and Volumes 2, Volume 2, as an audiobook for free. So take advantage of that by going to arkofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K, A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, Noah's Ark, arkofmillionsofyears.com. My guest tonight is Andy Bashago. Don't go away. We're going to talk about what's going on Mars and about viewing into time and the coming cataclysm. 40 seconds. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. You might think it's a little outlandish, but a team of physicists has teleported data over a distance of 89 miles from the Canary island of La Palma to the neighboring island of Tenerife, which is 10 miles further than the previous attempt at teleportation through free space. The scientists did it by exploiting the spooky and virtually unfathomable field of quantum entanglement. When the state of matter, rather than matter itself, is sent from one place to another, tiny packets or particles of light, photons, were used to teleport information between telescopes on the two islands. The photons did it by quantum entanglement, and scientists hope it will form the basis of a way of sending encrypted data. This is the same thing I was explaining to Dr. Jim Bell, who is the scientist at Caltech, 2 years ago. He is the guy that's overrunning the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, those little robots that have lasted years longer than they were supposed to. Are you ready to believe that we have, in fact, been teleporting the way Andy is describing? Welcome back to the program, Andy.
Thank you. Good to be back with you, Brooks. And let me just say that, you know, it's my position that there hasn't been a linear progression of applied scientific development in the West since the Manhattan Project because of the impact of secrecy. You know, when one of our more brilliant time travel theorists like Michio Kaku or somebody working now in teleportation makes a claim about how far advanced time travel research and development is, the problem is that those activities have been undertaken under the umbrella of state secrecy, so that even those working currently in this field do not know what has been secretly developed by the United States government. And so really the first individuals who would be benefited by a new paradigm in the United States of far more disclosure about applied scientific developments from the U.S. government would be the scientific community itself. I think ultimately they're the ones who are being cheated the most by not having access to information that has resulted from the 60 years of development in this area that have actually taken place. And so while I'm always fascinated by the news stories that are now being released about teleportation, about invisibility, because of my experiences in Project Pegasus, I know that these scientific milestones were reached 40 years ago. And so I'm waging my truth campaign first and foremost on behalf of the scientific community so that their brilliant minds and their time can be spent on developing new applications and new solutions to human problems rather than being engaged in trying to reinvent the wheel and not even being allowed to participate in improvements of the teleportation that did emerge 40 years ago. Obviously, if teleportation is going to be made safe for humans, you know, there were biomedical problems with it. It's my hope that today's time travel theorists can so develop teleportation that it could be made absolutely safe for humans in ordinary transport around the surface of the Earth. And so that's why I'm speaking out, and I really don't regard these occasional news stories about tiny incremental advances in this field as being at all possessing of any ultimate cosmic truth, because they maintain the falsehood that these scientific milestones haven't been reached. And in fact, they have been reached, and the people who paid for them, namely the people of the United States of America and their scientists, deserve to be told the truth that they have.
Well, yeah, and there's at least two levels of tragedy that go with this. One, and of course not the least of which, is the loss of astronauts' lives who have been strapped to rockets and launched into space needlessly. And the other is the idea that we have, in fact, received accurate views of what the future looks like and what it holds for our race and our planet. And somehow that knowledge has not been shared with the general public, but it seems with this special knowledge we are now engineering another colony on another planet with a select genetic makeup, certain individuals who are blessed with the governmental right of survival, while the rest of us are evidently going to go through some kind of conflagration.
Right, at least our descendants possibly, because we're not really sure when the cataclysm that they're preparing for is going to occur. According to Jay Widener, when the Bavarian Illuminati founded the United States in 1776, they knew that there were 666 years left before the Earth would again be incinerated by a periodic cycle of coronal mass ejections that have hit the Earth and devastated human and animal life and vegetation in the past. And so it was the date certain for the event, and hence the need to evacuate individuals to Mars, was initially the year 2442. He then describes how, with further study, that timeline was moved up to 2012. Now, my thinking here is that it may not actually be 2012. 2012 may be being used as a meme to convince individuals who are approached to go to Mars that catastrophe is imminent, literally several years away, when in fact it's the goal of the program is to get those individuals on Mars so that a sustainable civilization is created on Mars for a catastrophe that may be several hundred years away. I know that when I toured a deep underground military base under the Archuleta Mesa in New Mexico, the so-called Dulce base. It's near the town of Dulce, New Mexico, with my late father when I was attached to Project Pegasus in the early 1970s. And it took about 15 minutes to get to the floor of that thing. We saw floor after floor after floor of empty floor space. And I said, "Dad, what's the purpose of this place?" And he said, "It's for people to go when the catastrophe occurs." And I said, "Well, when is that going to be?" And he said, "Long after I'm gone." Now, my father died in 1990, and here we are in 2010. So from his perspective, the catastrophe that was going to strike Earth was in the distant future. So as I begin to correlate these different statements that have been made, when I examine the apparent artificiality, the sort of esoteric mysticism that seems tied up in the 2012 literature, I think what we're really looking at is a very sophisticated intelligence operation that is using the meme of 2012 to convince some people that disaster is imminent so that a change in their behavior can be worked. I can certainly say that Hunt had a number of discussions with me before he essentially convinced me that I had to go to Mars. There's an inherent pull of Mother Earth on all of us. Our ancestors have been here for thousands of years, and you have to get over that reluctance to leave the home planet if you're going to convince individuals to go, especially to as austere an environment as Mars, indeed, an underground civilization on Mars. And I think one of the ways people have been convinced to go is to simply convince them that if they don't go, they're going to lose their lives in an imminent catastrophe. I'm not convinced a catastrophe is imminent, but I am convinced that such a meme could be manipulated to convince people to leave, even if it's their far descendants 200 or 300 years in the future that will be ultimately be the harbingers of human race on Earth when human race on Earth is devastated by a periodic cosmic event of some time, some type that has been known about for many hundreds of years.
Wow. Well, I would like to get the feedback of some of our listeners. The call-in number is 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. Couple of thought-provoking questions, perhaps. One would be, are you ready to accept the call to go to another world and perhaps be the progenitor of generations of humans who may or human-Martian combinations that would someday be the survivors of Earth? And the second question is, do you think at some time, at least in one of your past lives or past consciousness, that you were asked to come to a planet called Earth? So those are the two questions I pose to the listeners out there. 415-762-1161. You know, Andy, in our travels, we've been to a couple of conventions. We've spoken to people from all walks of life who have reached some kind of realization that either they're not from here, they don't belong here, they're not comfortable here, they're not in the groove of Earth life. Maybe they're first-timers here, or they've got some memory that's being reawakened inside of them that perhaps they're not originally from this planet, but from another planet, and they've come here. We do have a caller, Mark from Ohio, on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. I had a couple questions for Andy real quick. Andy, can you elaborate on the spacefaring civilization that was on Earth and centered in Cairo? I believe you said 11,000 years ago. How well is this information known on the inside, and how did you learn about it?
Mark, that's a great question. In fact, it touches upon what I was just thinking about. What we know is that the previous civilization on Earth that flourished around the time that the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx were built on the Giza Plateau was an interplanetary federation that had a colony on Mars. What we know that based on, for example, the fact that the Great Pyramid itself is designed so that the passageway to the King's Chamber illuminates a red orb, namely Mars, on the wall behind the head of the pharaoh's sarcophagus on the same day every year. I'd have to go into the literature. I think it's on the summer solstice, but I'll have to check the literature. So we know that the Great Pyramid was, in fact, a celestial observatory focused on Mars. I have found, and my fellow researchers at the Mars Anomaly Research Society, Ross Curley, Lewis Michael Reinhardt, and others, have found evidence of Egyptian ruins on Mars. We found a sarcophagus of a king that I wrote about, that is of an Egyptian pharaoh that I wrote about in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars. Later last year, Ross Curley found a rock in one of the photographs that features not only an intaglio or carving into the rock of the head and face of a pharaoh, but the distinctive cylindrical hat that he's wearing features the unique cobra ready-to-strike motif of Wajit, which was the Lord Protector of Lower Egypt and then became the protector of all of Egypt during the reign of the pharaohs. We have both in Jay Widener's work and even in these allegations that were recently made by Laura Eisenhower that Freemasonry undergirds the project to establish this survival colony on Mars. You know, the Shriners call themselves, what, the Ancient Arabic Order of the Egyptian Shrine. We know that the overarching purpose of Freemasonry has been supposedly to reestablish or rebuild Solomon's Temple. I believe Solomon's Temple may ultimately prove to be the Great Pyramid at Cheops, and that this may represent metaphorically the Mars Project. We have the placement of the Egyptian pyramid on the money supply that was created under Masonic leadership in the United States of America. So we really have evidence from both the Earth culture and now findings from Mars that the high Egyptian civilization of the pharaohs was a spacefaring civilization, and it had reached Mars and left ruins there before the last cataclysm. And so this is really a major part of the conspiracy. It looks like Freemasonry has been a multi-generational project to reestablish that linkage to Mars. And, you know, I was astounded when Laura said, well, you know, these individuals who had infiltrated my life and were trying to get me to go there knew from Freemasonry certain esoteric things about Mars that are simply not in the popular literature.
You know,
so we also find that, you know, it was Karl Munk who found that the D&M pyramid complex immediately south of the face on Mars at Cydonia has an orthogonal geometric pattern that we find in three places on Earth, namely on the Giza Plateau, at Avebury in England, and it was also incorporated in the site plan that Pierre L'Enfant, the French urban planner, designed for President Washington, that forms the fundamental design of our nation's capital.
Yeah,
and so what we're seeing here is information is now coming in from different sources establishing that this really is the meta-conspiracy that undergirds Western civilization. It's a Masonic-driven conspiracy to reestablish the linkage between human civilization on Earth and the not only the civilization on Mars, but the need to use Mars as a survival colony for Earthlings before the next cataclysm befalls Earth. Now, where I found about it is really a synthesis of what I experienced and learned on Project Pegasus. We had different learning components that we were studying on the speed learning machines called tachistoscopes that had been designed by the Office of Naval Research. So some of my esoteric learning came from that. I was also a journalist for many years. I've been investigating my own experiences and talking to others who have the kind of valuable data that Laura has just provided, establishing that there has been this, you know, multi-generational movement, secret movement led by Freemasons and groups like Skull and Bones to reestablish the colony on Mars. But I would submit that if people don't want to believe the more conspiracy-oriented literature, just look at some of the photographs that my organization is starting to publish about what's on Mars. I mean, the face of the pharaoh that Ross found is a stunning archaeological discovery. I think it's as significant as Borchardt's discovery of the famous bust of Nefertiti. I mean, there on a rock on Mars, you see a carving of a form that can be nothing but an Egyptian pharaoh with the distinctive headdress of such an individual. So I think at this point the case has been proved that there are Egyptian ruins on Mars. Of course, other individuals who have studied Mars, Haas and Saunders, for example, point out the existence of Mesoamerican ruins on Mars. I think there are both distinctively Egyptian and Mesoamerican or Mayan and Aztecan ruins on Mars. But again, that civilization that built the high culture in Egypt and also built the ziggurats in Mesoamerica and in different locations in Asia was the same maritime civilization that had reached Mars. So we're really looking at evidence from the previous civilization on Earth that was interplanetary and was in direct contact with the human civilization on Mars.
You know, it's interesting, in the crypt below Dendera, which is a few hours' drive from Cairo by bus, you will also see the red planet, and you will see individuals who are not necessarily in temple dress, but they seem to be in the act of teleportation in a room that is colored red. And I didn't really realize it until you got to talking about the relationship between Mars and the Great Pyramid in Cairo. Until just when you mentioned it, I remembered seeing Mars and the red planet and a red room with a person in seated position on the walls in the crypt below Dendera. Now, this is originally the Hathor Temple, which was destroyed, and then another temple, the Temple of Dendera, built on top of it. And then outside the grounds of Dendera, you see copies of it made crudely out of mud, nowhere even close to the scope and glory of the previous temples. Really, really amazing stuff.
Right, and so now we're living in a time when you know, we already have the findings establishing the distinctive Egyptian orthography of the Cydonia complex. Just in the last several years, we're now examining the footage from the surface of Mars, which also shows this linkage to ancient Egypt, and that links up with, you know, the last 150 years of discoveries in Egypt of evidence that civilization, it wasn't just a matter of them reaching Mars in the same way that we reached the moon. There was an active nexus between those two civilizations.
Oh, yeah.
They were in frequent contact.
Mark, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I have one quick question. I know other people want to call in, and I'll get off here.
Yeah.
Andy, I heard you briefly mention that Lucifer was the name of the leader of the planet in our solar system that was destroyed during some calamity. And can you elaborate on this? And thanks a lot, and I'll listen offline. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks
Thank you
very much, Mark. Yes. According to one account, the catastrophe that ended the last civilization, this great maritime civilization on Earth, was a celestial event in which debris elements from the Vela supernova explosion entered our solar system and just utterly devastated Mars, leaving very large boulders in some cases that can be seen on the surface there, and also greatly impacting Earth. As debris fell into the atmosphere of Earth, that debris would have been illuminated. It would have brought light to the world as the world was being pummeled by a catastrophe involving rising sea levels, forest fires, and just utter devastation to that great maritime civilization that had built the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and had this ongoing active linkage to planet Mars. According to one account of the true history of the word Lucifer, Lucifer was actually the political leader of the planet that once existed in our solar system, where mathematics and celestial mechanics suggest it should exist, that was literally destroyed in that cataclysm, and hence the linkage between both the cultural diffusion of the information from that catastrophe as civilization began to regroup, and just the sort of the genetic coding of that catastrophe in the surviving human population on Earth, attributed to Lucifer some unique characteristics, basically an association with light, which was produced in great volume as this cosmic debris lit up our atmosphere, and
sure,
also evil, because clearly when you're in a high civilization and it gets rained upon by millions of tons of debris from space, this great lighting event is certainly going to be remembered down through the generations as something that was very evil, that some sort of evil god or force caused
sure
to be brought to the surface of the earth.
Yeah, absolutely. Dennis from Oregon, you're online too. Welcome to the program.
Hi, are you there?
Hi, Dennis. Welcome.
Hi, I just have a question I wanted to ask, and then I'll hang up and listen. There was a comment that what the Illuminati, for lack of a better word, it was almost a humanitarian decision to save humanity by doing this project, and yet everything I've found out or heard what they're doing is very inhumane. Some of the other whistleblowers that have come out and said things that have had experience with them. And if they have some kind of a compassion towards the human race and want to save the human race, what makes them so inhumane, as evidenced by, like, what the Nazis did and Dr. Mengele and those kind of people?
Well, Dennis, that's a good point, and I'd like to distinguish what you're saying. I basically agree with the presuppositions of your question. What I was saying was that ultimately, in cosmic terms, it is not a bad idea. It's a very pro-social humanitarian concept to try to provide for a survival colony on Mars, because if we're going to be intelligent creatures in the universe, we have to recognize that our planet has periodically been pummeled by some very disastrous celestial events. And so even if we don't incinerate ourselves in a nuclear war, our civilization could be devastated and the human genome could be destroyed. The human Earth-human presence in the cosmos could literally be obliterated. So in broad, overarching philosophical terms, it's a good thing to create survival colonies of human beings on the moon the Mars and other habitable or ultimately habitable planets. But I agree with your major premise that this secret esoteric tradition has been responsible for some of the most inhumane and genocidal developments on Earth. And actually the implication is, for example, in the area of genocide, that some genocides may have been launched to actually attrit that part of the human population that doesn't have genetic ancestry from Mars. I'll give you two examples. The black African population of Africa is now 50% HIV positive. If HIV was engineered as a biological organism by the U.S. Army, that is undoubtedly the result ultimately of a genocidal plot. Or, for example, the periodic genocide that we see in places like Cambodia, where there's been very little Aryan interbreeding during the last centuries, where, in fact, in some areas of the world, there's no Aryan presence. So I really embrace and validate or affirm that as your major premise. We're dealing with a multi-generational conspiracy that seems to be focused ultimately on the creation of a human survival colony on Mars. Now, creating a human survival colony on Mars is a good thing, but this multi-generational conspiracy that seems to have made it its purpose to achieve that has been responsible for centuries of bloodshed and also nefarious acts in our own time, such as the assassination of prominent and charismatic political leaders who have opposed the plot. They would be individuals, for example, like President John F. Kennedy. So I'm not lauding this group at all. I'm trying to expose it. I believe that because there has been a huge investment in this project, because trillions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer monies have been spent to create this colony on Mars, this is something that needs to be discussed publicly, and the genocidal eugenicist thrust of the secret faction that has been attempting to bring this about needs to be exposed and needs to be called to account for its abuses over the last several centuries on Earth.
So, Dennis, did that answer your question?
Yes, I appreciate it. You mentioned that you had been down to the Dulce base, I believe. Is there any validity to the idea that some of these people are actually reptilian?
I can't address that. I mean, there's a rich literature on whether a substrate of the human race is reptilian. I visited the Dulce base in around 1971, and just sharing my experience with you, it was absolutely vacant. As I described to Brooks in a recent conversation, going down that elevator, watching the floors, was like being in a metropolitan shopping mall of two or three stories where none of the stores had been furnished. You just had empty floors. But instead of just two or three stories like you'd find in a metropolitan shopping mall, it was several hundred floors. It took about 15 minutes just to get to the bottom of that. In fact, we had to be weighed, and we were wearing these strange rice paper pajama-like clothes that we had to dress into before being permitted to enter the elevator to just have the experience of going down to the bottom of that base. All that I can confirm is that the base exists. It has hundreds of stories, and in 1971, those stories were populated by nothing. I mean, they were basically just empty floors. And so from the perspective of a 9-year-old...
How long do you think they'd been there, Andy?
Huh?
How long do you think they had been there, those floors?
Well, Jay Widener is stating that a lot of our deep underground military-based construction has been in the rehabilitation of existing underground bases on Earth. It's been more of an extension project rather than an original project. I know that there's some very fascinating literature that indicates that some of the waterworks projects that were undertaken in Los Angeles, California, in the early 1900s, uncovered some existing underground bases that had, for example, reptilian statues and so forth in them. So I think it's intriguing who built the original underground bases on Earth, and what were they human beings like us? They may very well have been a different form of humanoid with a more reptilian component. But I have no direct evidence that the Dulce base had been occupied by extraterrestrials or reptilians. It was simply a large engineering project when we visited it when my father and I were attached to Project Pegasus.
Maybe even older than the pyramids. You never know, since the last conflagration. All right. Thank you very much for the call, Dennis. Please, please make a habit of calling back. Tim, you're on the program. Welcome. How are you, Tim? Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Yes, I believe I had the pleasure of meeting your guest at eCity last July. Was he a speaker there?
Yeah, we were there,
yeah,
right?
Was. Okay, and I had lunch with him, and I enjoyed the conversation tremendously. I had a question about this catechism that they have been preparing for. You talk about it affecting the Earth. Would it not affect Mars also?
Well, if it's a solar catastrophe, Mars has the benefit of being farther from the sun.
Okay.
It's certainly doubtful at this point whether seeking shelter in underground locations on Earth would allow individuals to survive something that was hot enough that came from our sun. I think it's really something that intelligent people can disagree about what exactly it is. But let me say this. We know that the U.S. government has undertaken a very expensive and extensive project centered on Denver, Colorado, and the airport there, but also encompassing this huge volume of deep underground military base construction under Colorado and New Mexico, for example, that clearly is a continuity of government system in the event of a cataclysmic event that they expect to occur in a meaningfully soon period of time. And so I'm not a planetary scientist, nor am I an archaeologist or historian who can comment intelligently or with great certainty about what exactly the event is going to be, but I have kept abreast of some of the leading theories. Jay Widener believes that it's going to be a coronal mass ejection that will incinerate the northern hemisphere and damage the Earth tremendously and lead to a substantial die-off of the human population. I think in the last event, the Earth population dwindled down to about 25,000 individuals, which would indicate
wow.
how narrow the human genome is, as Brooks commented on this broadcast. Others believe that it could be a random cosmic event that has nonetheless been detected by the chronovision technology that's been operational in the U.S. intelligence community for 40 years, following on the discovery of chronovision that was made by Arnetti and Gemelli. I'm not really certain what the event is, but I know that it is certainly considered a low enough summa number probability by the U.S. intelligence community for them to have used trillions of dollars to try to build a system of deep underground military base construction in the Four Corners area. And hence, I think it's something that we can... that we should take with, you know, consider with great seriousness. I think it's a very serious issue. Jesse Ventura just did an excellent broadcast about that system of deep underground military base construction and the belief by a certain faction within our U.S. intelligence community that it's not a boondoggle to start preparing in this way. So it's a fearsome thing to consider. Maybe it's something that only our descendants are going to experience, but at this point the evidence is overwhelming that the U.S. government has been spending trillions of dollars to prepare for both human survival on Earth underground and to prepare for human survival on Mars underground, with the benefit of the Mars colony being that Mars is farther away from our sun. And so that might
right.
explain...
Right, and it's not necessarily lined up with a CME that would hit Earth, would not necessarily hit Mars. The actual rarity of some linear... CME coming in the direction of Earth, also being in the direction of Mars, would be pretty rare. It would be quite rare, in fact.
Right. It would have to line up based on the positions of the planet at the time of the event. So as Brooks has just described, the fact that the Earth and Mars are moving in irregular orbits suggests that if that event does strike Earth, that at any time that it does, Mars would be spared.
Well, yeah, and relative to Earth, Mars's orbit is regressive. That is to say, it kind of does an S shape across the sky. It doesn't go around Earth. What we see is Mars traveling one way across the sky and then changing directions and traveling the other way across the sky because our ellipses are so far apart.
Right. So that may be a hidden advantage of celestial mechanics, is that Mars would make an apt lifeboat for human life on Earth, because any event that would strike the Earth would probably not strike Mars as well.
Have either of you heard the theory or the explanation that such a catastrophe may have been disinformation or possibly the misuse of looking glass technology or something along that line to kind of funnel funds and stuff into this type of preparedness in a false manner?
Yes, I have heard accounts that suggest that the Chronovision technology created some sort of problem involving quantum destabilization. Having been involved involuntarily, of course, but nonetheless involved in the early days of that, I don't believe that's the case. Both the teleporters and the chronovisors were creating dense effects, but they weren't effects. They were localized effects in the universe, even on the surface of the Earth. Now, I think that it is intelligent to speculate about the possibility that the notion of a looming catastrophe could have been used to create these deep underground military bases, for example, to sequester political prisoners in a police state. And certainly if there was a mass populist eruption of the U.S. population, the permanent secret government would be planning different facilities for the incarceration of individuals in deprivation of their civil liberties. So I think that we have to factor in the possibility that catastrophe thinking has been exploited as a form of disinformation, possibly, to prepare for a police state that would really be much more horrific than the police state that we already find ourselves in. But I, having been involved in the program as a kid,
appreciate that.
Not only knowing the engineers, but also my father being attached to the project, I'm convinced they were dealing with real cosmological issues and not a covert agenda begun by the Nixon administration to incarcerate mass numbers of American civilians.
Right, right. One of our write-ins, Andy, has asked if you have noticed the hieroglyphics in the newer crop circles, or if you have any information on the crop circles and who they are, because this crop circle season is almost here, and he says it could be a truly awesome season.
I've kind of focused on Mars, and I don't have a lot to offer to the discussion about crop circles. I haven't found a lot of evidence of the Earth-Egyptian connection. My own feeling is that the crop circles are extraterrestrial or interdimensional in origin and are from a higher level of organization than is implied by the connection between the ancient Egyptian civilization and the Martian one.
Yep, I feel the same way. Tim, yep. You got another question for us?
I don't, and I really appreciate your time and your efforts, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you very
thank
much,
you,
and
Tim.
We look forward to seeing you at eSETI again this coming summer.
I will be there.
All right.
Thank you.
You know, I find that we have a new culture evolving on our planet, and it could be because of the new neural net of the internet connecting minds together and memories together and maybe even various lives that have somehow stratified and incarnated around the planet and have thus lost touch with each other. We have forgotten how to telepathically communicate, but now we're communicating. I mean, we're really communicating real time. We're on internet radio right now all around the world. People listening in Australia, in Israel, in California, Canada, all over the world right now, all at the same time. And there'll be many, many more that come in Monday or Tuesday if you're observing President's Day, happen to work for the government or a bank. And they're going to listen to these archives, and they're really going to have their minds opened as to what's going on out there. Andy, you have brought the most stunning revelation about what kind of information this shadow government has been privy to over the last 40 years. One might say, who could resist? Who could resist having access to this knowledge? what in the world are they trying to engineer with our generation and planets beyond? What are your feelings now, 40 years after your initiation to the program? What are they? What have they learned, and what lessons have they learned from it? And I guess what I would say is, what have you gathered about what might be the plot of what they're trying to do with this information? How are they trying to engineer our future?
Well, when I was a child on the project, it was clear that the broad consensus inside the U.S. time-space program, now, of course, I didn't have contact with many government officials, and with only a few intelligence officials. Most of the individuals I was interacting with were the project engineers and scientists. But I was privy to enough of the shop talk to understand that the individuals that were developing quantum access for the U.S. government believed that it should not be used to play God and try to, for example, prevent a future event based on foreknowledge of it. And in fact, when they would reveal information to an individual, like they revealed to me the fact that I would be principally associated with the revealing of the fact that Mars is an inhabited planet, or when they would approach one of my contemporaries, a young Barack Obama, and tell him by age 20 that his destiny involved becoming president of the United States. Whenever they revealed an event like that from the future, I know from my interactions with my father that they delivered it to you in sort of a double positive way, so you wouldn't divert from the destiny that they had articulated. For example, my father revealed to me in the late 1980s that I was destined to attend the University of Cambridge. He said, so if you're invited to go there, go. In other words, he gave me a double inducement to do what they knew my future included. So I think the real situation is one in which, just on the level of intuitive or basic heuristic level, they didn't want to create a situation where the U.S. government would be playing God. Now, a practical reason not to do that is, if you intervene and stop a major event as a result of having foreknowledge of it, you diminish the value of your intelligence database because you've changed the course of human history and you've shifted the data set. So you're now not in possession of knowledge of the multiplicity of events coming after that major event that you diverted or prevented.
But what government official is going to resist picking up the cell phone and saying, Marge, listen, that trip you were going to make to the beach this weekend, cancel it. Don't ask questions. Just don't go.
Well, I think some of that has actually resulted, because within the councils of government, as President Eisenhower stated, and under the umbrella of this military-industrial complex, you have a class of public officials who are being briefed periodically on future events. And we find this in the 9/11 event. And this is really where I was going with my comment, is I think they've actually been imposing a rule of reason that when an event is very, very serious, literally, let's say, the destruction of a city via an atomic terrorist attack or something like that, that they will intervene and then try to catch up. And that's what I think may have happened regarding the invasion of Iraq and their belief that Saddam Hussein had acquired weapons of mass destruction. I think that was a finding of the fact that in the future he would acquire weapons of mass destruction. And when they decided to intervene in the present and topple his regime, they prevented the very future that they had prior knowledge of, but there was enough debris of the data set left around for even prominent public officials like Secretary of State Colin Powell to disgrace himself at the UN by alleging that Saddam Hussein had acquired weapons of mass destruction. So I think what they're doing is they're applying a rule of reason that if they're going to intervene and prevent a future event, it has to be serious enough in its consequences to deal with the practical problems of having to reestablish the database regarding future events when they do act to prevent a mega event that's going to have a big impact on the future. In regard to 9/11, I don't believe they believed it was a serious enough event to prevent, and I think they also wanted to use the event to install some of these police state conditions in our society that we're now oppressed by. And I was discussing how in the councils of government, individuals seemingly are using information from the future to do practical things just in the everyday carrying out of their political duties. We have, for example, the fact that on September 10th of 2001, Condoleezza Rice, who was then serving as National Security Advisor, placed a phone call to former mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, advising him not to fly on September 11th. We have the placement of Donald Rumsfeld's desk at the Pentagon on the other side of the Pentagon from where the missile struck the Pentagon. We have the statement made by President George W. Bush that he saw the first plane hit the first tower 24 hours before he would have been able to do so using conventional television feeds. So that creates a rebuttable presumption that it was as a result of chronovision that the president was given the data he needed to see the event as it was unfolding. So I think
weren't they also maybe not aware of the year that this was going to occur? They just knew 9/11, and so every 9/11 they kind of took some precautions?
Yes, and that would explain the presence of the FEMA team in downtown Manhattan on September 10th. And let me also say this. I think I have some original or personal information regarding this. When the 9/11 event was being discussed openly in the social network that encompassed Project Pegasus, when I was a child on the project in the early 70s, it was never spoken of as September 11th, 2001. It was always spoken of by the simple terminology 9/11. They knew that it was a domestic Pearl Harbor. They knew it was an attack on the country from whatever faction, internal or external. But I know that the year was never discussed. So I think that's right. They knew that a disaster was going to occur on September 11th, and so they contingency planned for that on every September 11th, and that explains the fact that a team from FEMA was already situated in downtown Manhattan the day before that particular 9/11.
There were a lot of very strange things about that event, the series of events. Now, I was watching Fox News in the morning. The first plane had already hit, and I actually watched the second plane hit on television from the cockpit of the helicopter that was covering the first hit. And the absolute shock and amazement of the helicopter pilot himself, who not only evidently observed it, but was expressing his complete shock and dismay at the event that he had just witnessed out the window of his helicopter. Now, I never saw that clip again, but I have people that tell me that those planes were all CG, everything was manufactured for television. No planes actually hit the building. It was nothing more than explosives. I don't know. I mean, I watched it. To me, it looked like a plane had flown into the side of the building. However, I do know people who are very privy to Israeli intelligence, and they tell me that they know the Arab mind, and they know the Arabs could never, ever have put together a plot like this, that the people that apparently flew those airplanes couldn't fly a biplane, let alone a passenger liner. So there are just a lot of inconsistencies with this whole darn thing, like the debris field in front of the Pentagon not lining up with what you would see with an airplane crash, the debris field underneath the plane that was that went down over Pennsylvania is not consistent with the plane that strikes the ground and breaks up, but consistent with one that breaks up in the sky and then falls to the ground over a couple mile area. Just things just don't line up with this. Evidence that doesn't make sense.
Because of these inconsistencies, Brooks, that I didn't speak out after 9/11 about the fact that Project Pegasus had prior knowledge of the event. I monitored what was happening by watching NBC News. And what I noticed the day of the event was that Tom Brokaw and Katie Couric were mentioning Osama bin Laden in every sentence. And I thought to myself, how could they be so certain that bin Laden had perpetrated this event? And if they were so certain that it had reached the councils of mass media, namely NBC News, why didn't they prevent it? And so I knew that a cover story was being implemented the day of the event. And because at that point I had been investigating my experiences in Project Pegasus for several years, I didn't want to contaminate both stories by saying, hey, everybody, listen, you know, the U.S. Defense Department had footage of this event 30 years ago, but in fact they did. In fact, my father and I saw that footage. It was processed at the Aerojet Corporation facility in Socorro, New Mexico. We were called down there and shown about a 20-second film loop of one of the planes hitting one of the towers that had been retrieved from the future and was being processed, and we were shown that footage at Aerojet. And so I knew that I had valuable information to provide what would become the social movement that would investigate what actually happened on 9/11, but I was concerned that if I talked about it during the years immediately after the event, both stories would sort of be pulled into each other. People would be confused about what happened on actually happened on September 11th when I shared with them the information that the U.S. government had prior knowledge of it 30 years before it happened. And my desire to fully articulate what happened in Project Pegasus would become a sidebar to the 9/11 story, and it was far more than that. So I basically didn't reveal what I knew about prior knowledge of 9/11 because I was concerned that both investigations would be severely damaged if I jumped into the fray too quickly after 9/11, when everybody's emotions were so raw and when so much discrepant data was being analyzed by researchers. But now, with the hindsight of, what, now almost 10 years, 9 years, 8 years, I can certainly, I'm certainly willing to consult with 9/11 truth movement advocates and researchers as much as they would like about the fact that a defense project for whom, you know, for which Donald Rumsfeld was the defense attaché, had footage of the event 30 years before it happened, and the 9/11 event was being openly discussed in the social network surrounding Project Pegasus in the early 1970s in New Mexico.
Wow. Wow. That is really, that's really earth-shaking, Andy. I know we just blew through the second hour. I know you're tired, but if you want to hang in there a third hour, I'm willing.
I'd love to do that, Brooks. Let's go for it.
Okay, let's take a quick break, about 4.5 minutes. We'll be right back with more Andy Basciago after this. Don't go away. Thank you. welcome you back to the third and final hour of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest tonight, Andy Basciago. His website is on X Squared Radio if you want to check it out. We'll get him to tell us about it here in just a moment. Remember, the phone lines are open, 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. The Ark of Millions of Years, as you know, is for sale as a trilogy. The shipping is a special deal. We ship them all together. And by the way, you get the audio for versions 1, or volumes 1 and 2, sent to you free. So that's about 40 hours of reading. If you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read them for you. And you can enjoy the books, have them on your shelves so people can know you're reading the very best books written on the 2012 end times. Also, don't forget to check out the the first episode of True TV Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. We did a special on HARP, and I reenacted what HARP pulses can actually do to a cloud in a cloud chamber live on television. So check that out. Keep yourself up to date on the latest information. We'll be back in 40 seconds with Andy Basciago. I appreciate you. We're in our fifth year, 2010, on BBS Radio. It is by far the highest quality web network out there, still growing, still expanding due to the never-ending love and dedication of Don Newsom, our producer, and we appreciate him as well. My guest tonight, Andy Basciago, we're talking about time travel, or at least time viewing through the chronovisor, teleportation, and the fact that we have not only viewed a coming cataclysm, we're not exactly sure what year, but we know that the nature will be global in its scope. And also the fact that the neural net of the Internet seems to be connecting people from all over the world, and there's a remarkable metamorphosis going on in the human race. My question, Andy, by the way, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Brooks.
Is the coming of the Internet and what it would do to the landscape of the human race, was this viewed by the chronovisor, and how did the government react to its metamorphosis?
Well, let me make clear that there were a number of both prominent individuals and prominent events or social conditions that were apprehended in the early 70s by Project Pegasus. And it wasn't just as a result of the chronovisor. It resulted from sending people into the future via Tesla-based teleportation. It involved sending them there to retrieve microfilm summaries of future events that were then brought back to the present, which was ultimately the thrust of what I was involved in on the project as a child, separate and apart from the later trips to Mars almost 10 years later. So what we're really talking about is an intelligence project that was using different forms of quantum access, everything from using gifted child psychics to sending adults to the future to retrieve information and bring it back. Now, among the events that I know they knew by 1970-71 as a result of what was being discussed on the level of shop talk within the project was my discovery of life on Mars. That was actually evidence of that was actually shown to me. I was allowed to read my paper, my 2008 paper in 1971, and I was also shown different excerpts from the paper. Other events that they were aware of, obviously of much larger magnitude than that, was, as you say, the advent of the Internet. They were aware of that. They were aware of the emergence of AIDS as an epidemic disease. They were aware of the 9/11 event, as we discussed during the last hour, and they knew through different ways, the identities of a specific set of presidents that I can confirm. the U.S. presence that I know were talked about or that in some way reached my awareness, who were future presidents that they were aware of holding the office of president and chief executive in the early 70s were Presidents Carter, President George H.W. Bush, President William Jefferson Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, as well as Vice Presidents Richard Cheney and Albert Gore. I do not remember President Reagan being discussed, but I do know that they were using different methodologies to discern who would be president. And part of the paradox of this, I want to make something clear, because people are trying to pose a threat to the validity of my claims by taking contemporary notions of quantum physics and using them to sort of vigorously scour my facts and try to find some inconsistency about my presentation of my evidence. Let me just, I want to make myself clear here, because I think I've been treated somewhat unfairly regarding this issue. Project Pegasus did prove the existence of the multiverse. However, the multiverses that were being detected were virtually identical versions of the same past event or future event. So, for example, when they sent me to Washington, D.C. in April of 1865 to try to see who assassinated President Lincoln, and this, again, wasn't actually being sent there. This was virtual time travel as a result of standing in the hologram when they turned the chronovisor device on. So it was essentially a virtual experience of that event. I found myself in the same event, but every time I was sent to that same location in time-space, the event changed a little bit. So, for example, somebody else walked past me in the lobby of Ford's Theater. Now, but the other thing that I'm sharing with people is I know that by, when I was still in the project, so this is, we're talking by 1972, I do know that they had a predictive model regarding future intelligence. I cannot explain the discrepancy. In other words, I don't know what technical advance they made that both affirmed that we live in a multiverse with discrepant adjacent timelines, as it were, and that they also had enough of a predictive model of intelligence gathering about future events so they could describe with certainty who a particular future president would be. But I'm sharing that information with the public because it's the truth. In other words, the truth that I'm sharing involves that inherent paradox, where they were sampling multiple timelines, but they knew, for example, who would become president. Now, the explanation that I've posited, as somebody who has begun thinking about these issues in quantum mechanics like everybody else is that the major events and people are present in all of the adjacent timelines as a result of their magnitude. That is a possible explanation for the discrepancy. But it's not an inherently cosmic invalidation of my account. It's part of my story. It's what I'm trying to share. I'm trying to explain that they both discovered the multiverse and that adjacent timelines are pretty much like Groundhog Day, that old Bill Murray movie. They're basically the same thing happens, but it's different a little bit. You know, a different waitress comes over and takes your order in the same restaurant. Okay? But at the same time, it was evolved enough by the time I was separated from the project at the end of the summer of 1972 for them to literally be able to say that the individual who's going to be elected in 2008 is somebody named Barack Obama, and he's going to be America's first African-American president. I mean, they were able to isolate a specific event and the destiny of a specific individual because these kinds of intelligence findings were being openly discussed in the context of the project. And they included, of course, the major development that you've cited, which is the advent of the Internet. And so I wasn't privy to all of the different forms of quantum access, nor was I anything more than a child percipient in the experiences. I was not a project principal, and quite frankly, I don't know how they evolved a predictive model regarding specific future events or the role to be played by specific people. What I am doing is the honorable thing, which is sharing the fact that the U.S. intelligence community has capabilities that are far in advance of what has been revealed to the public because they have had this predictive capability since the early 1970s.
I'm reminded of actually a Delbert comic where Delbert is saying, in the future, I choose the soup and not the salad. And so I'm going to choose the salad. Does that mean that my view of the future was wrong? So
again, evidently, it's a conundrum.
It doesn't mean that Delbert's view of the future was wrong. It means that he had a glimpse of the future in which he made one choice. And so now, empowered with new knowledge, he consciously made another choice. He chose a different future. So with the advent of the Internet, I think what happened was the proliferation of knowledge into the hands of naturally intelligent people, not necessarily institutionally trained, like through a college or a school of some kind, but are just naturally intelligent, get their hands on knowledge, and they become greatly empowered and greatly creative in their own right, not just in this country, but in even third world countries. One of the most popular things in Iraq right now is a satellite dish, so that people and the Internet and actually gain knowledge of the outside world, and better, send knowledge out. And it's really an unpredictable, almost chaotic mathematical model in which numerous futures can evolve simultaneously. I would think that you could look at the future through this chronovisor as many times as you want, and each time you look, you're going to get a slightly different future. The bottom line is this: we are now empowered as a human race to choose another future, with the exception of these coming cataclysms. Evidently, these things are in motion, you know, millennia before they actually unfold. So how we react to that future, however, is our choice. How we evolve as a race and how we stand and elect people is actually a choice. So do you have a feel for whether Obama is going to be a two-term president or whether there's going to be another name come forward in the next few years?
There was certainly nothing negative said about Barack Obama as president or his presidential performance. I didn't even learn that he would take the presidency during a period of economic depression. All I learned was his name. In fact, my father stated his name to me. I had met Obama when I was an undergraduate at UCLA. I was introduced to him by an ally of Barack Obama's in the anti-apartheid movement. This was a white South African who I met on the UCLA campus, who was there lobbying for divestment from the University of California from South African corporations. And so we were having a very voluble discussion about political economy. I had just interviewed Buckminster Fuller in October of 1981 as a college journalist, and my mind had sort of been inspired to think in different areas of political economy and futurism as a result of meeting Bucky. And this conversation on the UCLA campus led to this individual inviting me over to his apartment in West Los Angeles, where he introduced me to a young undergraduate, my age. In fact, Barack Obama, I think, is 44 days older than me. He was born the previous month of August of 61, if we're to believe the birth records. But he introduced me to Barack Obama, and when I met Barack Obama, he explained that he was in Los Angeles, quote-unquote, hanging out with his friends from Occidental, because Barack Obama had spent his first 2 years of college attending Occidental College in Eagle Rock, California, out near Pasadena. He then transferred to Columbia, where he was immediately placed under the tutelage of Zbigniew Brzezinski, then employed as a political science professor, an international relations professor at Columbia, who had just served as national security advisor for President Carter. So I met Obama a year after he had been at Columbia, and yet he clearly had been apprised of his destiny as president, because as our discussion about the significance of the transnational corporations devolved into sort of an argument, his friend admonished me, well, you better be nice to him, Andy, because he's going to be president of the United States someday. And then when I joked something like, oh, well, maybe we'll pitch against each other in the bottom of the ninth on the seventh game of a World Series, he said, no, you don't understand. We know he's going to be president. And Barack Obama used the opportunity of that to sort of break away from the conversation. And as he was walking up the stairwell inside the house, this apartment that his host was occupying, he looked over at me and shook his head, affirming what his friend had said. Now, in the law, that would be a verbal act that would be tantamount to what we call a tacit admission. He he didn't deny the truth of what his friend had just asserted, which was the very dramatic claim that they knew to a personal certainty that Barack Obama was destined to be president. What they didn't know is that the UCLA student they were dealing with had spent a major part of his time between age 7 and 11, you know, from 1968-69 to 1972, immersed in the very defense project that gave the U.S. the technical capability to discern who would serve as president in the future. And I kind of see the hand of divine providence in this incident, because this allowed me to establish the data points that connect up with the Bushes. My father and I met both George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush in the context of the project, and they clearly had just been informed that they were destined to be president, because George W. Bush was all over the restaurant that we were having lunch at, joking to the different project personnel, "Have you heard? My daddy and I are going to be president." Okay, so these are two chance encounters with recent future presidents that establish the truth of the political world that we're living in, which is one in which people authentically run for president, but if they are one of the winners, they know on the day that they announce for presidency that they're going to win, because the U.S. intelligence community, in possession of technologies that afford for quantum access, are approaching them as young men and telling them, look, you know, it's going to be difficult, I imagine, for you to deal with this, but you're destined to be president. So that's what I know about Obama, and it's what I know about the Bushes. They were aware of their destinies because they had been informed of their destinies. But whether or not Barack Obama is going to be a successful president, how long his regime is going to last, whether he'll be reelected to a second term, I simply don't know, because I wasn't apprised of that information.
I almost wonder if the winner knows he's going to win, does the loser know he's going to lose?
Well, John Edwards and John McCain and Hillary Rodham Clinton and all the individuals that ran in this last cycle, Governor Bill Richardson, you know, I have somewhat of an insider's view of government as a result of serving in a defense project of a very serious nature as a child. And I know that one of the things about military service or government service is that you are often reviled, notwithstanding the fact that you're evincing the highest level of service on behalf of your fellow Americans. So I do not possess the jaunted opinion of our political or intelligence or military leadership that a lot of Americans do. I think that's a ramification of a kind of a post-Vietnam sensibility that really doesn't go to the fact that a lot of decisions that are made in government and a lot of people who are in government are really very much like us, and they're making decisions that we might very well make if we had the responsibilities that they have had to make certain decisions. So I'm actually kind of eager to reach out to those who have lost in their pursuit of the presidency to let them know that the process that they were engaged in involved a fundamental undermining of the constitutional processes of selecting president and vice president to the extent that the winners have been apprised of the ultimate outcome. I don't know whether those who have not successfully reached president and vice president were also aware that they were just sort of going through a set of campaign experiences and debates and so forth that ultimately would lead to one of them being selected. I'm not saying that there's been a top-down manipulation. I do not embrace, for example, the claims of somebody like David Icke that American presidents are selected by blood and not elected by ballot. I believe that they are elected by ballot. They have legitimately contested for the presidency and the vice presidency and won it. And I think in life you have to be a big person. You have to congratulate other people for their accomplishments. And so I don't possess the jaundiced view that our political leadership is corrupt and isn't basically peopled with a lot of positive, energetic people. Obviously very ambitious people and sometimes manipulative people, but nonetheless, people who are very much representatives of the American character. But I do think they deserve to know that the discrete winners that we've seen during the last six or seven administrations, at least from the time of President Carter, maybe earlier, maybe even encompassing knowledge by President Ford when he was appointed vice president and then ascended to the presidency without being elected when President Nixon resigned, from around that time of the early 70s, mid-70s, the losers of those elections really deserve to know, especially since they evinced such an effort to be elected president or vice president that there was some a selection pressure on what was going on that they probably were not briefed on and went goes far beyond what they would have believed as could be possible at that time.
Well, one of the things that greatly defines presidencies is the event, the major event that happens during that presidency, whether it's a depression or a war or a terrorist act. And one of the things that I personally feel is being shaped in the media is at least the perception that Iraq is headed toward becoming a part of the nuclear weapons community. I see this in the press, and yet I see the streets of Iraq filled with tens of thousands of protesters out of control, not in control by the government, surely threatened by them, water cannoned by them, gassed by them. We don't see foreign press in there giving us the full story. And I, for one, have become a little skeptical of American press. I have a feeling that we're being manipulated into thinking that, okay, now we've had a significant number of years in our war on terror, and now we need a more solid enemy. And that enemy now is Iran. So Iran is going to join the ranks of nuclear weapons capability. And the real fear, and I see this being developed in the press, various stories coming out, first on the right, then on the left, this press, that press, this newspaper, and now mainstream, that Israel is preparing to retaliate against Iran's nuclear capability. And I have friends in Israel who feel that this is a very real possibility. So what's going on? Are we going to reshape another presidency with another great war against another sovereign nation to prevent them from becoming part of the nuclear community?
You know, I just don't know based on my project experiences. There was one data point that related to the Middle East when I was on the project, and that is during one of the Montauk chair probes, I gave the technician working with me what I had seen, which was smoke over Baghdad. And he said, well, what are you talking about? I said, I was watching CNN. And he said, what's CNN? And I said, the cable news network. And what was happening? And what was happening was the bombing of Iraq during the advent of the Iraq War.
Ah.
And so, you know, this is the kind of discrepant data that was... This was the kind of data that was being accumulated by the project.
So we have a smoking gun event from the future, and it could be the shock and awe attack on Baghdad that took place during Bush 43.
Right. Yeah, that's the kind of data that was being collected, Brooks, was, a child seeing the television images of an American bombardment of Iraq, but they weren't able to gather information about the intricacies of politics that would indicate, for example, the necessity or the tragedy of an Israeli strike, let's say, on Iran or Iraq. Now, since then, we don't know how advanced the quantum access technologies have become, and you also point out what a lot of people are indicating, which is the degree to which the mass media is being used to essentially create a false reality regarding events of major significance. You know, I cited the fact that on the day of 9/11, Tom Brokaw and Katie Couric mentioned the name Osama bin Laden, I think, 250 times on the air. And so I think what we're really looking at is that an authentic media is emerging in the Internet as the result of independent researchers and journalists and so forth. And yet there's still this mighty Wurlitzer, you know, that Operation Mockingbird established to use the mass media as the leading form of propaganda. And so I really think that we're living in interesting times to the extent that we're not just seeing the truth about this, the role that's being played by quantum access and the way it's actually been informing government all these years, but we're also seeing a discreditment of the mass media resulting from the Internet. And now people are going to see more clearly that the mainstream media is essentially the fourth branch of government, and has been actively misinforming us for decades.
Well, it's not just the news media either. It's also mass media in the form of movies and science fiction, actually preparing, I feel, the society with not only encounters with beings from other worlds, but maybe alternative viewpoints of our connection to planet Earth. I think Avatar was certainly a breakthrough on several different levels, but it rang so amazingly, I'm going to say it rang true, not the idea that we can inhabit avatars, but the idea that maybe we're connected with our planet in a far more literal way, both energetically and spiritually, than we could imagine. I think maybe Earth, or at least the inhabitants thereof, are being prepared through the engineering of science fiction. What do you think?
I think they are in the metaphysical area by the best and the most spiritual science fiction. But I'm a little bit more cynical of science fiction than that, in the sense that I think that science fiction evolved as a genre to be used for disinformation. The classic example, of course, is that Star Trek debuted on American television in 1966, purporting a form of teleportation that was diametrically opposed to the kind of teleportation that had then emerged in the defense technical community, one that didn't involve disintegrating somebody and reintegrating them at their destination, but in fact involved opening up a tunnel in the time-space continuum through which they passed. We have also Madeline L'Engle's book, A Wrinkle in Time, was dropping some of the project information from Project Pegasus into the public. The Pegasus image, the Tesseract device in that novel, of course, is an anagram or a contraction of Tesla Energetic Array. CW, the Charles Wallace, the child protagonist in the book, is shorthand for Curtis Wright, where it was, of course, at Curtis Wright in Woodridge, New Jersey, where they set up the original Tesla device that they discovered was a teleporter. So science fiction has been used so that individuals like myself who step forward and describe what the government has been up to and what the state of actual technical development is, so that their claims can be ascribed to themes that have emerged in science fiction and hence don't have a basis in facts. I think it's a much more complicated picture than science fiction simply inspiring us to imagine the world that will be. I think that science fiction also has been a form of disinformation that confuses the public about the existence of certain technologies.
So, in your opinion, do you think science fiction is used in a somewhat organized fashion to desensitize the public to the idea that there are, in fact, races from other worlds here on Earth, that we will be visited by races from other planets, and that it won't be done, in a clandestine manner anymore? We're about to have global first contact.
Well, there's an example. In different movies, first contact is described as a momentous future event that never ultimately seems to occur, and in the sense that the best contact films position that blessed event of contact with another civilization from elsewhere in the universe in a kind of a fantastic way. At the same time, we know our government's been in liaison with different extraterrestrial species. So we've seen films like E.T. or Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the film Contact, and the public has been encouraged to dream about the world and our worldview that will exist after we acknowledge that we're not the only intelligent life forms in the universe. But there's never really been a leading feature film, for example, that has shown the fact that the U.S. government has been in liaison with different extraterrestrial species. So I think that's another example where first contact is postulated as a future event that will change the world or change the universe or our conception of it, but in fact, first contact has already occurred and is covertly informing the destiny of our planet, but that but that the information that would educate us about what that destiny is not being shared with the public.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And I have a fundamental argument with destiny. Destiny is just the most likely probability of futures. But that probability is strictly determined by the population of energies that are used to create it, which means if you have a rather uninformed public who are making up the mass of the population of consciousness in the system, then you're going to have one outcome. But if you can awaken community to a different possibility and even focus or shape it with some kind of popular icon that, you know, to which people can focus their energies, then you can redirect that destiny and have another future become engineered out of it, especially if you had prior knowledge that one future led in the wrong direction. And might I add, and I want you to elaborate on this, define wrong direction.
Boy, that's a tough question. You know, we have the fact that Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Heinlein, I believe it was Heinlein, shared adjacent desks at British intelligence during the war. So I think it's a very complicated formulation. We clearly had the emergence of a literary genre and a film genre, namely science fiction, that is very, very important because, among other things, I think, as you indicated, take, for example, something as well-produced as Star Trek, you know, through the genius of Gene Roddenberry. People are being introduced to the fact that we are inhabitants of a planet, that we are basically one species, although we possess different characteristics, and that we have a common destiny and purpose that we should embrace with the philosophy that we're members of a team, of a purpose that is larger than ourselves,
right,
that we can contribute to, and that's important. You know, the survival of human race in the universe and the sustainability of this beautiful planet that we have inherited. On the other hand, science fiction seems to have been used to prevent the public from grasping exactly where the state of technical development of our civilization is. So there's been sort of a misinforming or a disinforming thrust of science fiction as well. I think that if you look just at the rich literature of science fiction about Mars, a lot of the science fiction has been pretty positive because it's allowed readers to go there and think about inhabiting another planet. And it's introduced people to Mars in the same way that the National Geographic introduces us to the ecology and civilization of different areas of the Earth. So I think we can say that a lot of science fiction has kind of steered humanity towards a positive future, and by so doing, let's say, obviated a future of mass chaos. But then there's also this deep political or ethical issue involving the fact that science fiction has repeatedly disinformed the public about the true nature of technical accomplishments by primarily the U.S. government, but clearly other governments, the Russian government to include. And those technologies are profoundly important in terms of the choices we could make in the future. I mean, one of the reasons I'm speaking out about the fact that the U.S. government achieved a teleportation capability by 1970 is we may need teleportation to save our planet from the effects of global warming if we continue to persist in relying, for example, on internal combustion engines in our automobiles. I mean, there was one study that indicated that if China embraces a two-car per household standard, namely the American standard of ownership of internal combustion-based automobiles, that itself may result in flooding of major cities around the world. And 70% of humanity on Earth lives within a one-hour car drive of an ocean. So we're going to have to be creating a more sustainable technical infrastructure in the 21st century, and I think the truth movement is going to help bring it about. As whistleblowers like myself reveal to the public the different technologies that have been developed by the U.S. government and around which a program of declassification and technology transfer should be launched so that these technologies can be used as part of the solution set to the crisis of environment and economic development that is upon us.
Well, I couldn't agree with that more. I think that we're being shaped where at least the attempt is being made. I think when the designers who are trying to design our future, who are trying to at least engineer our future, try to consider the media through which they can make these designs, to which they can put these ideas into our minds and into our social mores, are using media. They're using movies. They're using music. They've always used Hollywood to shape popular opinion of war or of politics, and I think they continue to do so, and especially with the idea that you have put forth that through the chronovisor and through actual travel through time, they have gained knowledge about the possibilities of futures that in their minds at least give them some justification for doing so. Is that what you gain from your knowledge as well?
Absolutely. In fact, I mentioned earlier how there was a consensus on the project to not play God and intervene and prevent future events based on prior knowledge of them. And then there's the practical paradox of not wanting to intervene and prevent too much of the data that you know about, the events or individuals that you know about, because if you do that, you can change the future enough to completely diminish the quality of your intelligence database about the very future events you were studying with these advanced technologies. And so I think the presumption has been one of non-intervention. In fact, there were discussions when I was a child on the project that this information would be used to engage in contingency planning for future events, but not to play God and try to prevent specific future events. And that's why I think we saw on 9/11, and I think it may be very sophisticated at this point. It may have even gone to, let's say, asking certain songwriters to write specific songs that were very heartrending that were performed on national television immediately after the event. Now, being not just a New Jersey-born kid with some Italian ancestry, in fact, a Virgo ox like Bruce Springsteen, I won't criticize the boss, but, you know, if you look at a song like Bruce's song, My City in Ruins, which he said was written about Atlantic City, New Jersey, where he lived for a number of years, but which is so evocative of the sense of being emotionally bereft after we saw those majestic towers fall in downtown Manhattan. That song was played for the first time on national television at 8 o'clock at the top of the hour, about a week after the event. And when I look at these forms of use of the mass media to influence the population, I have to ask myself, the contingency planning that was discussed in Project Pegasus when I was a child in the early 70s, would that include, for example, the intelligence community working with a brilliant musician like Bruce Springsteen to write a song to have a certain effect on the population in the event of a mass disaster like 9/11? You know, I'm not disparaging Bruce because he's a phenomenal individual and a phenomenal artist, but I'm just saying those were the implications of what we were told was going to happen, how they were going to engage in contingency planning about mass events or major events in the future, but not try to change them. And I think, separate and apart from, you know, a particular response to the tragedy, like the playing of My City in Ruins shortly after the event like that, we have the whole question of the use of official state propaganda to influence people's thinking about Middle Eastern terrorism and to create the foundation essentially to pass the Patriot Act after the event. So I think, we have responses to these events that seem to authentically emerge from the culture of the country, you know, a Bruce Springsteen song. But then we also have the constant drumbeat of propaganda from our elected leaders and from the mainstream media that indicates that the kind of contingency planning that may have been implicated following the emergence of quantum access actually involves the scripting of official responses. And that would explain, for example, you know, Tom Brokaw and Katie Couric mentioning the name Osama bin Laden something like 248 times on September 11th. And so, yes, I think the technology is advanced enough and the government infrastructure of manipulating mass media in a form of elaborate contingency planning in relationship to the event is something that we have to be mindful of, because I think it's occurring.
Yeah, and I can tell you that engineering went on exactly as you say. You know, I went back and I looked at the primaries, and I looked at Ron Paul's response, where the Fox News news guy was the mediator of the primary debates, and he was excoriating Ron Paul for making the assertion that we had done something with our policy or with our actions that drew the ire of Osama bin Laden against us, and somehow through which we deserved what happened in 9/11. Now, Ron Paul wasn't asserting that, but he was certainly saying that our policies kind of, you know, got us into a problem because we were assassinating and financing rebels and usurping and overturning governments that had been, you know, risen to power the natural way, because we wanted something else to happen with that government to further our ends and not the ends of that particular sovereign nation. Now, I look back on it now, and I don't look at it with the same revulsion that I did the day I watched that debate. I said to myself, oh my gosh, how in the world could Ron Paul ever assert such a thing? I had been manipulated, along with the rest of America, by very careful and inflammatory rhetoric, which had been timed and beaten into our heads, you know, over the months following 9/11. And yet now when I look back on it, I say, wow, what an incredibly clear-thinking man he was. He actually hit the nail right on the head. So
right,
of course,
and because this sort of fallacious political culture has emerged, that's why it's so important for all of us, you know, to really try to achieve, you know, Bruce Springsteendom, and try to be as authentic in the messages that we share with others. Because, look, we've got a political and a media culture that is propagating memes, not just based on immediate political response to the news of the day and everything that's occurred before a particular day, but that in some cases is percolating through the Council on Foreign Relations and the other unofficial ministries of government based on the dissemination of information about future events.
Yeah,
and therefore,
yeah,
if we're not to be victimized and victimize others by this sort of perpetual environment of disinformation, we need to strive to tell the truth and be authentic as individuals as much as possible and let go of our prejudices and avoid accusations regarding things about others that have no basis in fact. You know, I've been amazed that I'm running a solo law practice and I'm sustaining my truth campaign on my own wages. I've been unfunded. I'm certainly not working for the government. I'm certainly not a disinformant because I'm trying to be very careful in framing the truth of what I know, and I'm often saying that I don't know something, so I'm not prevaricating and filling in information when I don't have it. And yet
right,
I'm consistently being called a paid government disinformant in postings that are made against me in chat rooms and on Facebook and so forth. In fact, quite absurdly, the opposite is the case. Right now I'm a totally unfunded, independent voice with no connection to the government, and certainly nobody in the government has ever asked me to come forward with this information. In fact, the only time the U.S. government approached me regarding my research and writing and advocacy in regard to Project Pegasus, it was a meeting held in Colorado with a representative of the executive office of the president who admonished me to shut up. So this is, I think, what the truth movement is dealing with. We have a few voices of individuals who are trying to share critical information with the public that we can now do through the Internet to cut against the grain of official disinformation that has evolved into an elaborate culture of official state secrecy on the one hand and of unofficial state propaganda on the other. And those of us in the truth movement like myself are rather regularly accused of being paid government disinformants, and I'm sorry to say that, or happy to say, that just is not the case. I find that very unfair. Again, you know, you have an example of somebody like a Ron Paul. I think Ron Paul's attractiveness as a candidate and a potential president is essentially his personal authenticity. He tells it like it is, and I think that gives him a certain grandeur or magnitude as a potential president. I find a similar quality in Jesse Ventura. Now is a time for truth. And I would love to see a Ventura Paul ticket in 2012.
Wow, that's exciting. I mean, you'd have a lot of power and a lot of no-nonsense, I think, delivery there. Because, you know, one of the things I like about Ron Paul is he'll say something like, what, am I too Republican? Am I too conservative? You know, what is it that I have said that has made me not appear Republican? All I have done is tell the truth. And when you go back and look at it, you go, gee, that's exactly right. Now, it might not have been politically expedient of the day, which most politicians just throw the finger in the air and say, oh, gee, which way is the wind blowing now? Which baby do I kiss? Which camera do I face? But not Ron Paul. He's much more genuine than that. And I found it refreshing in politics. Really quick, we have about 4 minutes left. Andy, disclosure. You're almost a lone voice in the wilderness with amazingly privy knowledge, and your disclosure was even foreseen in the project itself many years ago.
Correct.
When is the other shoe going to drop? What's happening with disclosure?
Well, I know based on information that was provided to me when I began my investigation into my experiences in Project Pegasus in the early 10s, you know, around the year 2000, now going back 10 years, that my truth campaign would ultimately lead to societal adoption of teleportation. In other words, it was critical to know that in the future, as I began to write and talk about my experiences in applied quantum physics and Project Pegasus, that the ultimate political outcome would be a declassification of America's teleportation capability, and we would use it to transform long-distance travel around the world. That's why later in the spring here, I'm going to be asking Secretary Rumsfeld and Governor Richardson to step forward and publicly acknowledge the existence of the program, the teleportation capability that the U.S. government is in possession of, and their involvement in Project Pegasus, so that my personal and historical account can be affirmed by individuals who were in the project, who were my elders at that time, and now obviously are very prominent American public servants. I was also informed of the fact that my research and education campaign in regard to life on Mars would result ultimately in societal adoption or understanding of the fact that Mars does have an indigenous ecology and civilization. So I
See,
wasn't
now,
given
the
timeline.
That's the most profound revelation of the 21st century, I think.
Well, I think it's an important. I think it's part of the timeline of the 21st century, and I must say that when I make such a dramatic claim of not only having found life in NASA's photographs, life forms, but also that I was on Mars, and then I have the great granddaughter of one of the great presidents of the 21st century, Dwight David Eisenhower, stepping forward to corroborate my claims, I really do feel sometimes that the hand of what George Washington called divine providence is on my shoulder. I'm deeply moved by Laura Eisenhower's decision to step forward and also the courage shown by her ally, Kylea Light, in making this disclosure event happen. You know, in other words, disclosing the fact that they were approached to become part of the Mars survival colony project that's in place. So I don't know the timeline for those two developments, namely societal adoption of teleportation and societal adoption of or understanding that Mars has an indigenous ecology and civilization. But I do know that that's the ultimate consequence of my work. And so what I try to do is just do the footwork and let God and the universe take care of the rest, because, you know, I'm a happy warrior at this point because I know what the outcome is going to be.
Well, that is great. And I'm glad we can be one small part of it here on X Squared Radio. I can't
well,
thank
you're
you.
A fundamental
by
part
the way,
of it,
what's
I
your website? It's projectpegasus.net.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I will soon be posting my information about the people, the places, the technologies at my Project Pegasus website, which is projectpegasus.net. And on March 22nd, as the zodiac goes into Aries, which seems to be of such esoteric significance regarding Mars, the Mars Anomaly Research Society that I'm the founder and president of is going to be releasing about a six-month backlog of all of our findings on Mars. And just to give you an idea of some of the depth of that material, we've done photo resolution of some of the glass tubes on Mars the tubes that formed the subject of Miles O'Brien's last broadcast as a 17-year veteran science reporter for CNN. And we are happy to report that we have images of either life forms or statues inside the glass tubes. So there's
wow.
either a kind of a museum of statuary inside the glass tubes, or there are literally Martians of different shapes and sizes walking through those tubes, perhaps to access the surface of the planet from areas underneath the surface of Mars, where they can look out through the glass tubes and look out on the landscape on the surface. But we've done enough work with the glass tubes to have found literally life forms or shapes inside the tubes.
Wow.
So we're going to be releasing a huge reservoir of findings like that we've accumulated over the last 6 months on our March 22nd Aries event, as we're calling it. So stay tuned for more transformative information about what's actually on planet Mars.
We absolutely will. And thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the program tonight.
Thank you, Brooks. I really enjoyed it. Have a great night.
Oh, I did too. Thanks, Andy. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
So our guest tonight was Andy Basciago. His website, projectpegasus.net. You can learn more about it by going to xsquaredradio.com. Subscribe to the archives if you're not already a subscriber. And listen in again. Share it with your friends. We are changing the way we view the future. We'll see you next week on X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth explorers.